Hello, welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This podcast is about Naeem Mohammed's film Two Meetings and a Funeral, which I first came across in London at the Tate Britain, where Naeem had been shortlisted as part of the Turner Prize in 2018. And I was really captivated by the film because it took me back to a time in Colombo when I was growing up there in the 1970s. At that time, Sri Lanka, like lots of other post-colonial countries, was very heavily involved in the Non-Aligned Movement, which was an organization of newly decolonized countries that had come together to try to stave off the domination of the two global superpowers, the United States and the USSR. So non-alignment meant precisely that, not to be aligned either with the agenda of the US or the USSR. Naeem's film is about the non-aligned movement, and it attempts to capture the dreams and aspirations of decolonization that were invested in this movement, and also to explain the failures of that moment. The reason the film resonated so heavily with me was that I have very clear recollections of the fifth non-aligned movement conference that was held in Colombo in August 1976, because my father was peripherally involved in the preparations and I tagged along to watch and witness a city being transformed, to see new roads and boulevards being built, and to see incredible modernist buildings being constructed to host the conference. What I witnessed was the theatricality of this geopolitical moment, where leaders of newly independent countries were performing their independence and solidarity. They were dressed in military garb in some cases, they wore national dress, and they were manifesting the challenges that newly independent countries faced. One of those challenges was that there was no ideological unity or consensus amongst these non-aligned countries. So there was a socialist-oriented bloc led by Cuba. There were more liberal capitalist-oriented countries, including Sri Lanka, but certainly Singapore and Malaysia. And the other very important thing that Naeem's film brings out is that there is an emergence of a block of countries that were Islamic in their orientation. The film focuses on two meetings. The first is the Non-Aligned Movement Conference in Algiers in 1973, and the second is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation meeting that took place in Lahore in 1974. And the juxtaposition of these two meetings is a device for telling the story of how the utopian aspirations of non-alignment started to fall apart, partly because there wasn't this unity and consensus that they were trying to foster. So why should we care about a film about two meetings that took place nearly 50 years ago? Seems like a very prosaic thing to be thinking and talking about. Well, in the current moment, we are asking ourselves questions about the possibilities of transnational solidarity, whether that be in the context of the disintegration of commonalities in the European Union, or the possibility of concerted global action on the environment or in response to pandemics. The possibility of global solidarity around key priorities and ideas is a absolutely vital horizon of our time. There are aspects of this horizon that also involve utopian dreams. So if we are to ask ourselves, you know, what are the challenges faced by these aspirations, then we need to look back to try to understand what were the previous attempts at transnational unity, what were those dreams and aspirations, and why did they fall apart? Naeem's film is called Two Meetings and a Funeral, so we should ask what the funeral is referring to. At first glance, it could be referring to the fact that many of the charismatic leaders that we saw at the meeting in Algiers, or indeed in Sri Lanka in 1976, met violent and tragic ends. But I think there is more to it than that. The funeral in the title of Naeem's film is referring to a more deep-seated failure of people with the best of intentions and aspirations coming together to build a better and more just world. So it's absolutely vital that we try to learn from what went wrong in that movement at that time. One of the key things we can learn from the non-aligned movement is that it's not enough to be against something. We have to have a clear sense of what we are for. The events of the 1970s addressed in Naeem's film raises the question of what happens on the day after independence. It is a question that continues to resonate in post-colonial countries and more widely as we tear down and jettison unjust institutions and formations. So these are among the questions that Naeem and I explored in our conversation, which took place in London in February. I should make a note that you will hear us coughing and sniffling away. We were clearly both unwell, and I should emphasize that it wasn't COVID, and we're both fit and healthy right now. Naeem Mohammed, thank you for joining me on Countersign. Perhaps you could begin by telling us about how you went about finding and extracting the stories that went into the film Two Meetings and a Funeral.
One thing maybe to start with is the, which is the question of generations. Yes. And generational transmission, because there's always a fuzzy gray zone in the transmission where things are not getting transmitted as the elders might have wished it to be transmitted. Right. And that's, of course, always where I first hear these stories from people who are witnesses of that time and who want to pass it on, maybe don't have people to pass it on within their own family, and then find someone else who's interested in these stories. And I almost always find that when they tell the story I receive is something very different, which I think is very much related to the condition of post-colonial disappointment.
Yes.
Which my generation feels much stronger than the independence-adjacent generation. In the Bangladesh context, but in many others, the independence-adjacent generation has both the memory of the moment, the struggle, the uprising, the war in the Bangladesh case, and how that clarifies things. And they feel, and they are, part of that moment. So that has strong utopian yearnings attached to that. And it feels, to use that term, it's a shining moment. Then come all the moments afterwards. And the moments of disappointment come very rapidly to these countries, certainly in Bangladesh. It's kind of related to what I think I read it in Hannah Arendt, as well as many other places, the problem of post-coloniality, where your governance has been removed from colonial masters to your own leadership, but the leadership itself hasn't been decolonized, right?
Yes.
So the leadership is still carrying all those processes of oppression, extraction, etc. So then for that generation, which is the independence adjacent generation, they have the shining moment and they have the disappointment afterwards. And what they inhabit is a mixture of these two. My generation full on grew up in the space of the aftermath and the wreckage, actually, which is not to say that we are necessarily always in melancholia, but there's a strong feeling of inhabiting disappointment and not even inhabiting the up moments. So when I hear these stories, when I first hear these stories, which then lead to these projects, essays or films, I'm often already thinking about what went wrong, and I don't have the comfort of having experienced the euphoric moment either. So Two Meetings and a Funeral came about actually from a story I first heard during my PhD fieldwork. You know, the fieldwork was, of course, with focused on text and audio, but of course, from within that came out this film. And the story I heard was about the non-aligned movement in 1973 in Algiers. And it was presented to me as an example of Bangladesh finally appearing on the world stage.
Mm-hmm. So this is a sort of shining moment. And I think it's worth clarifying that the emergence of the non-aligned movement in 1961 and then the Algiers conference in 1973.
Right.
Is part of the great ferment
right.
of decolonization. These
right.
are these countries who are throwing off the colonial yoke.
Right.
And they are coming together through the non-aligned movement
right.
to resist recolonization, if you like, by the superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union.
So right, like, right. And I think the thing that's crucial is you mentioned the Soviet Union. So that's why it's different from other alignments,
yes.
where by then, in particular, I think India, Yugoslavia, and a few other countries have become nervous about the Soviet Union as an ally as well.
Yes.
So non-alignment is really, of course, resisting the United States, but also starting to resist the Soviet Union. And the non-aligned movement is a complicated, unwieldy structure because, for example, inside non-aligned movement is Cuba. And Cuba in particular, as far as I can tell from my readings of material, definitely took the stance of wanting to stay close to the Soviet Union. So
yes.
there were people within countries within non-aligned movement that wanted to be completely free of Soviet alignment, and there were some who wanted to stay near that. And that, for example, as my film shows, really burst into the open in 79 when the non-aligned movement fails to condemn the Russian invasion of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, even though that's one of the things that the non-aligned movement was always banging on about, actually, that an attack on one is an attack on all. I even have the quote from that about that in my film, I think from Anwar Sadat. But I'm getting ahead of the story because that's actually when non-alignment reveals the weakness of the structure and the extremely unwieldy alliance. But going back to the 60s, when the non-aligned movement is getting going, forming, and then 73, which really is the peak meeting, there are a couple of things going on. One of them, of course, is to be outside of the Soviet and American axis and build a third way, quote unquote, because in many ways it doesn't succeed in being third way. The other thing, I think, is a workaround of a juridical problem, which is that at that time, for decolonization, for a country to appeal to nation state status, the United Nations is the platform on which you have to go to appeal. And the United Nations is controlled by maybe precisely the countries that are the colonial powers. So, for example, this really burst open for Algeria, where when Algeria is trying to become independent, they're making the case at the same global platforms where France has a dominant position.
Yes.
And then they're doing it almost as, I remember reading this thing where the Algerian delegation shows up and it's an extremely uncomfortable thing for the French government, but it doesn't capsize the French government either, right? Because those are not international forums where the Algerian government in exile, not yet created, has a vote equal to the French government, right? And I think non-aligned movement became a way to have another platform, which is outside the United Nations, where you can make the case for nationhood. And specifically in the Bangladesh case, which is what I've actually looked at closely, Bangladesh was blocked at the UN from UN membership after becoming independent by actually the Chinese veto.
Yes.
And the Chinese veto was being done on behalf of Pakistan, which didn't have that veto power. And so if you look at the newspapers of 72, 73, there's headlines about China blocks Bangladesh again. Quite ironic now that Bangladesh is very close to China. So those old alignments also don't matter in the current period political realignment. And so Bangladesh actually goes to the non-aligned movement to try to find a workaround. And this is how the story was told to me by actually a lawyer, Barrister Amirul Islam, who was the advanced delegation that set up the Bangladesh trip. And then the actual delegation had another lawyer, which is Dr. Kamal Hussain. So these are two old lawyers of that generation who were involved in drafting the constitution. And so they see Algiers purely from a, not purely, but greatly from a lawyer's viewpoint, that this is the platform where we went to make the case, yes, for Bangladesh, because we were failing to at the United Nations. Yes.
So this is very significant because it's the moment, the Algiers conference is a moment when Bangladesh receives recognition
by the non-aligned movement.
By the non-aligned movement. And if, of course, that is an international platform.
Right.
This is an international organization,
right,
of the emerging...
Right, it's a workaround of not receiving the recognition in the United Nations. And of course, then United Nations recognition also happens. But the thing is, where I was going with the generational transmission is, I was being told this story during field work. And it was being recounted to me as a very proud moment. Leaving aside the legal mechanisms, it was Bangladesh's appearance on the world stage. Because there hadn't been another international event of this scale that Bangladesh had gone to. And in the opening speech, one of the speeches, actually Indira Gandhi, makes a point about new countries arriving. And she says, I am glad that Bangladesh has joined us, yeah, right? And obviously India is one of the sponsors of Bangladesh's arrival. So there's a little bit of an announcement to the world stage aspect. And this is what the elders told me. This is how the story transmitted. But inhabiting my space, I, of course, instantly thought of the problem of 73. The problem of 73, as I saw it, is that 73 is an introduction to the non-aligned movement. But inside the non-aligned movement is this subgroup, or you wouldn't call it splinter because it was quite large, which is the Arab bloc, which also overlaps with the Islamic bloc, which hasn't quite fully announced itself. I mean, it is starting to. And the way it announces itself the next year is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation meeting in Lahore. And my film is, of course, explicitly about this pivot from the non-aligned movement to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And specifically, the behind-the-scenes event that happens is Bangladesh comes to the non-aligned movement, which you can say is socialist-oriented, not Soviet-aligned, has a strong decolonial ethic and aesthetic. Arafat is the star of that event. He's given a hero's welcome, and the Palestinian movement is talked about repeatedly by almost every speaker. And then explicitly, if not funds, then a sanction is made to create funds for supporting the Portuguese colonies. So that's armed rebellion being supported, and South Africa is also cited. A lot of this is in the speeches. Nobody's actually talking about the funding, but you can presume that if a meeting talks about Mozambique being independent, out of that meeting is going to come, yes, funding, right? So all of that is also happening. But the Islamic bloc is also starting to coalesce. And that meeting is also where Bangladesh is brought back into the Islamic fold, because it's seen as a country that has left the Islamic fold by splitting Pakistan. So I don't know if all of that will be instantly apparent to your to the listeners, because I'm also sketching out things for which we need a piece of paper and,
yes,
lots of lines.
Extremely complex,
right? Yes. Complicated. But I would say that instantly, generationally, I could see the complications where my elders saw the shining part of the moment. Yeah. But I think that also comes from their experience of the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm not experiencing it, I'm hearing it.
So for the independence adjacent generation, as you say, the 1973 conference is the moment of recognition,
mm-hmm,
international recognition,
right,
of newly independent Bangladesh. But we also know that the non-aligned movement itself has its internal ideological divisions. So,
right,
there is a more Soviet-aligned, mm-hmm, part of the organization, which is led by Cuba, You mentioned the failure of the non-aligned movement to object to or...
In 79.
Afghanistan is invaded by the Soviet Union. There is the oil-rich Arab countries.
Which is just starting to come into 73.
With OPEC being formed and also the oil...
And this is after the 1973 Israel-Arab war.
Yes.
So there's also a recognition that that path didn't work.
Yes.
So OPEC is also coming into its own as a political force.
Yes. And there's also, I mean, within, so there is that... ideological split, but there is also a more liberal capitalist-oriented part of the non-aligned movement.
Right.
And we'll come to talk about Singapore
And Malaysia.
So lots of tensions within what would have been understood, at least on the surface, as a socialist-oriented, pro-independence,
and
decolonizing force.
And unified,
right?
I don't think they were unified at all. I just want to throw out one other thing. Two other things, actually. Footage that I didn't use in the film, but I looked at a lot, was the footage of the planes arriving of each leader of the country. I didn't use it partially because, you know, Algerian television charged the same rates that charge French television producers. So footage was extremely expensive. I had to be very parsimonious. So I just decided, you know, the airplane footage is, it takes about 5 minutes for the plane to simply taxi around before the person comes out. And I thought, I can't afford this 5 minute footage. But the thing I did notice is that as each of the leaders of the newly independent countries arriving, what airlines they're traveling.
Right.
And they're almost always traveling, actually, the sometimes the airlines of the former colonial powers, or, you know, they're flying Air France, or those things were also there. You know, which country's airlines are you flying into? Often not their own country's airlines. So that's just a small hint about economic power, which, of course, the Singaporean foreign minister, Rajaratnam, also talks about. The other thing that I, of course, definitely noticed is that there were a few, of course, leaders who came in military regalia.
Right.
So that reminded you that this is a military leader running his country, right? There was, I'm forgetting which country, but a Latin American leader who spoke in full military uniform, and then I looked it up, and there had just been a coup about a year and a half before. So non-aligned movement didn't have a structure to say that if you had a military uprising and you came to power through a military coup, you're not welcome because it's a club of Democrats, because it wasn't a club of Democrats. So that's the other thing, right? I mean, Gaddafi also came to power through a coup, granted overthrowing a non-democratic government, but, you know, this was not a gathering heavy on people elected by the popular vote.
Yeah. And this, I think, comes out beautifully in the film, which is the aesthetics of decolonization, in a sense, revealing the political realities at the time. So partly leaders wearing military fatigues or khaki uniforms and so forth, very much also copying the symbolism of colonial rule, suggests that either they have, as you say, come to power through a military coup, or they are still, in their minds, fighting colonization.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that, of course, Castro, who continues to wear...
Green fatigues. And Gaddafi wears a variation of that, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the so-called, you know, that I think what was in the 1970s referred to in very colonial terms as a safari suit.
This
kind of style.
We had that Gaddafi, in Bangladesh, too.
Yes, and in Sri Lanka. Gaddafi, you know, symbolizes this charismatic... leader who is projecting their power through their military uniforms. And of course, Marshal Tito.
Right.
Josip Tito of Yugoslavia, is presidential bling.
Right. I mean, he wears a white suit.
Yes.
Yeah, but very dramatic.
But often also switched to a military uniform.
That's right, yeah. You know, people often comment on the fact of how young... and handsome Gaddafi was at the time, they don't notice actually that it's a green safari suit. I also heard a story in the TV archives, don't know if it's true, but the story was that when he first got off his plane, supposedly he had his pistol on a side holster, and he was told he needed to go back into the plane and take that off before he could come out, otherwise Boumediene wouldn't meet him.
Right.
And the actual footage that exists is of him and Boumediene standing, that is in my film, standing. I mean, they're very young, very stiff, erect posture. And you look at that image, I mean, I think that's why I'm trained, or not trained, my orientation has always been to think of what else is going on. You look at that footage, and it looks like two strong leaders standing side by side. Yet, 10 minutes before seeing that footage, I had heard that story that he had been told to go back into the plane.
One of them had been disarmed.
Yeah, if that is true, let's say. So you look at that image and you go, is this a moment of two brothers in arms? Or is this like a very sort of tentative, you know, because they're all rivals also for each other. I mean, Gaddafi was trying to stake out his position as leader of the Arab world. Boumediene was trying to do the same. Sadat tried and failed. Sadat actually both, I think, at the Non-Aligned Movement.
This is the President Sadat of Egypt.
Of Egypt, both at Non-Aligned Movement and in OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation, next year, is the only one, I think, who's wearing a pinstripe suit and smoking his pipe. So he clearly was also trying to project, you know, he could have chosen to wear some form of Arab national clothing, but he wanted to project, I'm the suit-wearing intellectual, or not intellectual, but some sort of alignment,
yes.
Which of course went tragically undone for him because he, to talk about another thread that's a bit invisible but underneath, is he among this consensus, broke the consensus by signing the Camp David agreement with Israel. And as the film shows, immediately he was isolated from everything, you know, isolated from Non-Aligned Movement, isolated from OIC, all of those things, became somewhat of a pariah. And yet in the film, you see him giving this speech, which suggests, you know, we are all for one, one for all,
yes.
Kind of a sense. So there are all these, you know, the film is a paradoxical event for me because depending on who sees it, they see something very different. You know, people see a lot of glory in there, and there are some glorious moments, but the cracks are visible in the same moment. And I'm not trying to uncover the cracks. I'm just trying to understand also with such high hopes, how did things go wrong?
Yes.
And I think that's where also my the generational transmission, there's a little bit of static in the noise. My elders in Bangladesh want to transmit a certain kind of story, and I am, from my position, seeing the gaps already as they're telling the story.
Yes. I mean, in a sense, it's a good point, I think, here to ask ourselves why is it that we're interested in this story from of this movement from the 1960s and early 1970s? And part of the reason is that it presents a certain kind of political horizon that was available, seemed to be available at the time, and you're also pointing to the fact that it was already cracking.
The contradictions were already embedded within the movement, right?
And I think even in the present moment, when we think about what the horizons might be for the left, what would be a left political horizon in the world of
with presumably a global South core, one would hope,
And what is the condition of that global South core, given the movements to the right that are taking place in the larger countries in the global South, as well.
And which, by the way, just to mention that a lot of the right-wing movements, it might seem counterintuitive, seem to command a larger share of what we traditionally would identify as a working-class vote, using other levers, not necessarily economic emancipation, but emancipation from some sort of demographic anxiety.
Yes.
Immigration, of course, comes to the fore as a way to get a working-class vote to a right-wing agenda. Not necessarily always promising jobs, but promising other things.
Yes. So this is, and this goes to the heart of the national question. That is, it seems being realized at the moment of decolonization, that nation states are emerging and they're throwing away, throwing off the imperial constraints. But at the very moment of this throwing away of the imperial constraints and becoming sovereign nation states, they are themselves internally engaged in conflicts, dealing with ethnic minorities, and having anxieties, as you say, about their near neighbors. And this is something that is also part of the overall context of the 73 Algiers conflict.
Right. I mean, I think just thinking about, I mean, I work a lot on Bangladesh or on stories adjacent to Bangladesh, right? Some of my films have been about, you know, one film is about the Japanese Red Army, but at the moment when they hijack a plane to Bangladesh. One film is about a Dutch academic who dropped out of his PhD program and joined or was allied to the Bangladeshi Maoist underground. These are all adjacencies, right? Bangladesh itself, I think, I mean, is of interest to me because it's where I'm from, where I grew up, what I know the best. But if you're outside of Bangladesh, just looking in, it also is an accidental laboratory for all sorts of post-colonial options. And one of the things that it shows is what happens when you first split India into Pakistans, and yes, then you split Pakistans into Pakistan and Bangladesh. Certainly one thing that is clear, and maybe this is because of my particular focus, is the position of the left continues to get weaker and weaker with each of these divisions, yeah, rather than getting stronger. And I think, I feel that for Bengal, which is the United Province, half of which went to India, it's clear that certain things that were organizational potentials in United Bengal split the moment partition happened, right? So you lose half the country, that means you lose, you know, your peasant base gets split and your leadership base gets split. People have to choose which country they're going to be in based on religion. You know, majority of the Hindu leadership stays in West Bengal, does not stay in East Pakistan. I think that's tremendously, it's damaging for the Bengali communists because they get split. So, I mean, that's also from my filter of what I'm interested in, what I'm ideologically aligned towards. And then when Bangladesh happens, the Bangladeshi communists become, it seems, I don't know if they become weaker, but they certainly don't become stronger, right? And by the late 70s, they're basically extinguished as a political force. Whereas in 72, 73, and even before 71, you would see articles in magazines like the Far Eastern Economic Review, which was, you know, based in Asia and had a particular interest in business but also political alignments, and generally, of course, anti-communist in its orientation, they would run articles like, you know, Dawn for the Red Caps, you know, that they would see a communist uprising arriving in Bangladesh, even in the Pakistan period. And they would take a neutral tone, but if you know the Far Eastern Economic Review's politics, it was clear that that was generating anxiety for them, right? When you look at those headlines from the point of view of even 79, you think, where did that uprising go? You know, did the journalists overstate the cause, or was there real potential and it got collapsed? And I think in the Bangladesh context, the way it got collapsed is that the appeal to national liberation, the appeal to nation state, the appeal to language meant that you could mobilize and unite both a peasant population base, an industrial worker base, and the nascent middle class, based on the appeal of having your own nation state and your own language as your primary position and your own quote-unquote people as leading the country, as sufficient.
Yes.
You know, what wasn't discussed is what kind of economic society it will be, which is why after Bangladesh becomes independent, you have things like the first five-year plan, which is very Soviet-oriented. By the time of the second five-year plan, the thing has changed. People in the planning commission resign. They resign very politely, but you think, okay, if the country's top economists resign from the planning commission, something's going wrong with the process of whatever variation of socialism this is. There's a whole debate about what's going to happen with the factories. Right? The factories get nationalized in 72-73, which actually runs them into the ground. Jute, which is the main agricultural crop that earns money, is the center point of all political arguments in the 60s. And the argument is that we grow jute, it's the golden fiber, and West Pakistan takes all the money. By the 80s, jute is finished as an industry. And that's after a decade of nationalization. So something goes very
badly. Which has something to do with the transformation of global transport and shipping,
right,
and
right,
you know, do you need jute sacks anymore,
yeah,
to transport goods and so forth. So that's a very important sort of point you're making, which I want to hold on to, which is firstly the relationship between language and the newly emerging nation,
mm-hmm,
state. We see this in a number of places. Certainly Sri Lanka is another example of this, where Sinhala nationalism is very closely tied to the Sinhala language,
mm-hmm,
and in fact the Sinhala only legislation that is passed by S.W. Adi Bandaranaike in 1956, which is often seen as the beginning of the amplification of ethnic tensions between,
right,
Sinhalese
and those who don't speak it,
and
the Tamil population.
The Tamil,
right,
population.
Ours is 1952, basically, when there's an attempt to pass such a law,
yes,
and the attempt fails because of language riots.
Yes. Nation formation through language to unify peasants and the middle classes and so forth, really runs aground on an international terrain of economics and mm-hmm. trade. Mm. And this is, I think, something that, to come back to Sinnathamby Rajaratnam,
mm-hmm.
he's extremely aware of
right.
the dependency that newly independent countries have on the erstwhile colonial powers in
right.
terms of communications, technology generally, and mm-hmm. finance.
Mm-hmm.
So he's provoking people in 1973, and he's trying to get people to think about
mm.
this reality. And that's something that really comes out quite
right.
powerfully in your film.
Yes, so Sinnathamby Rajaratnam, foreign minister of Singapore, he emerges to me also in a very particular way. There are quite a few elements in the film which were not the elements I knew about going in, and there were surprises found in the archive. One, which we haven't talked about, is the discovery that Allende was killed just 3 days after the conference, which I didn't think about at all, wasn't on my mind until I saw the footage of Kenneth Kaunda saying, you know, we are sorry
yes.
that Excellency Allende cannot be here. And only after seeing that footage did I go to the internet and look up the dates of the conference.
Yes, that's right. It was the other 9/11.
Yeah, the other 9/11, which totally was not in my head until I saw that. And that actually, that discovery actually really led me to think about the failure to condemn the Afghan invasion, because these are all milestones, right?
Yes.
73 is a milestone. 79 is a major milestone, because not only does the failure to condemn the Soviet Union collapse non-aligned movements' claims to legitimacy in many ways, moral legitimacy, but also the Soviet invasion ends up being the imbroglio that, you know, bankrupts the Soviet Union also,
yes.
right? I mean, the Soviet Union goes bankrupt fighting that war, and it gives the United States this tremendous amount of moral legitimacy after Vietnam, because here's the Soviet Union fighting a Vietnam-like struggle against a people that clearly do not want the Soviet Union there. So that's a whole other thing. So, as I mentioned, the Kenneth Kaunda footage, what should be mentioned is Kaunda speaking in English, right? Most of the footage in the Algerian archives is in Arabic or French. So I always had this lag where I would listen to it and I would have to have somebody translate it. It's not instant. And the English footage is rare. So the Kaunda footage comes out. And then Rajaratnam is on day 5, I think. He's at the very end. He's not an important figure in that configuration. He is given, I would say, what is the loser slot.
Yeah.
When people are restless, the hall is not full at all. If the camera rolls, big bulky things that can zoom but also can turn. And I think
yes.
people were not aware of the camera's zooming capacity. So one camera is on the speaker, but one camera is roving the audience. You see various things. So during Rajaratnam's speech, you notice that some seats are empty. I've spoken about this at a talk I gave at this conference at Tate Modern, where I spoke about and I showed the footage that shows the camera panning, and you see many people's headphones are off.
Yes.
And you know these are people, such as Gaddafi, who don't understand English well enough to not need translation. Therefore, the conclusion you draw is that Gaddafi thinks, some guy from Singapore, I don't need to listen to this.
Yes.
Right? So you also notice that his words are falling on deaf ears, literally,
yes.
with headphones off. You know, people are engaged in their own conversations. You see Arafat greeting people. There's other things going on. And so maybe that also freed him. Because from the points of view of diplomacy, he does something quite extraordinary, which is that, this is not in the film, but is in the talk I gave. He gets up and he says, you know, you all have already received a copy of my speech because I had to give it to the translators. So I'm not going to repeat that speech. I'm going to instead deliver some extempore remarks, although his extempore remarks are very measured. And I noticed in his biography that he was a member of the debate club. And he says, I will therefore set 2 records at this non-aligned movement conference. I will give the shortest speech on the record. And I think that's a dig at Castro and Tito.
And the tendency to give very
right.
long speeches
right.
and break records.
Right.
And so
which is why the talk I gave at Tate was called the shortest speech.
Yeah.
And then he says the second thing is, and you will get 2 speeches for the price of 1 plane ticket. It's quite extraordinary. You know, it's gentle, but it's a dig at the organization,
yeah.
right? And then he goes on to say, the thing that is in the film, which is that the machine broke down and we could not fix it.
Yes.
And I knew when I heard that footage, I said, I bet there were some German technicians that
yes.
had to be flown in and they had to wait 8 hours for the flight.
Right.
You
so
know?
This is the point about who's making the technology,
right.
where is the technology
right.
coming from? Technology is power
right.
and it is still owned and run by the colonial, former colonial
right.
powers.
Right, right. I mean, at Goldsmiths, we talked the other day about event
yes.
Based history or event-based alignments. It's definitely an event-based thing to take an anecdote about the machinery breaking down and turning that into the beginning paragraph of your speech. But I can imagine that Rajaratnam was also sitting there going, what the hell is going on? We're denouncing the West and we're waiting for some European technicians to come because there's nobody in Algeria who can fix this live transmission equipment, right? So he's has a sudden moment of revelation of they control the technology. What are we talking about?
If we're talking about talk to each other.
Without the intermediation. He gives the quite beautiful example of sending a telex and which countries it has to go through, which is also a different kind of technology point. He then goes on to say this thing, which I think is not in my film, but is in the original. He's quite extraordinary, the things he said. And I remember thinking, after days of listening to be honest, really tedious speeches, which say the same thing in the same meter. It's just a question of length. And everybody talks about, you know, Palestine is what everybody talks about. It's like the platform of the speech, which is great, but also at the same time there's a repetition that after a while makes it look quite performative. And then Rajaratnam is this little bomb that explodes in the middle. So he goes into this statistic, which is in the record, not in the film, where he talks about how many children are born every minute, then every hour. So he does this multiplication thing every day. And then he says, in the 5 days since this conference has begun, this is how many children have been born. And this percentage
in,
of it
in the world that we represent. So he's saying, you know, this is in the so-called third world.
And the majority of it is in the world. What are we, and he says, what are our speeches going to do for them? It's such a clear crystal moment, which basically says you don't have an economic plan. You have the plan of decolonization and celebrating decolonization, but what happens the day after? And what I felt when I saw this footage, because Malaysia repeats the point. I don't show the Malaysian form, but repeats the point. And I felt like Singapore and Malaysia arrived and maybe had already met in advance and had decided this was their talking point. And he says, some of you have oil. We who don't have oil, what will we do? We have to trade. And so it's...
So trade becomes a major thing. Part of,
and it falls on deaf ears.
For ASEAN, which Rajaratnam goes on
I mean, not to make too much about one meeting, but I remember thinking, I would think he went to this meeting, he came out of it, and he thought, this is not going to work. We need to find something else. And so he probably was already thinking and working on ASEAN, but focused on that because he realized this global conglomerate was, first of all, too unwieldy. There were too many players, there were too many army officers and non-democrats and people who maybe because of oil wealth or for other reasons didn't have to face trade yet.
Yes.
You could defer trade as long as you had oil wealth girding up. I mean, my family, myself included, lived in Libya in the 70s because Libya was importing labor based on oil wealth to build up the industry. The problem with importing your labor is that you imported skilled labor leaves and you haven't built up skilled labor in its place, right? And then when oil shock hits, then that economic basis suddenly disappears. I mean,
two things that come to the fore at this moment. One is the economic policies of the non-aligned movement and non-aligned countries that Rajaratnam
wanted to
kind of shake up and pose questions about and obviously charter a course out of. And the other very important thing about Singapore is its multi-ethnicity.
Right.
So Rajaratnam is also very conscious that he is one of the leaders of a country with multiple ethnic groups, the Chinese, the Indians.
And he's not necessarily the dominant ethnic group either.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's
not in the leadership at least. Right.
Exactly. So, in many ways, certainly for me growing up in Sri Lanka in the 1970s, in the midst of the ethnic strife and conflict, Singapore is seen as a shining light, a shining light on the horizon. And many people on these two points, firstly, on the economic point, will now often condemn Singapore as this neoliberal formation, right? Like it embraced capitalism, it became the city in the city and nation in the East. That was a gateway for Western capital to spread itself in Southeast Asia. But for other countries such as Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and so on, when you look to Singapore, you were seeing a place where ethnic conflict at least didn't exist in the amplified and very violent way in which it existed in other
ways. Or was put aside as a built consensus for the sake of, I mean, it's definitely a consensus that was built.
And manufactured. It's manufactured in the sense, I understand Rajaratnam was involved in writing the national anthem. The anthem has to be repeated by school children every morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an affirmation and reaffirmation of the multi-ethnicity of Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense in which Rajaratnam himself is extremely self-aware that he's a certain kind of father of a new post-colonial nation that has these potential conflicts and problems, both ethnic ones and economic ones, and that he's got to charter a way out of that. And I think that in terms of thinking about the third way that the non-aligned movement represented at the time in the 60s and 70s, Rajaratnam seems to come up with, a fourth trajectory.
Right. I mean, some people would say Singapore could also afford to do that because Singapore wasn't actually, you know, Singapore wasn't in a geography that was adjacent to any of the hotspots that were discussed.
Right.
Singapore felt that they had organized their way out of colonialism in a calm way. At least that's certainly how Lee Kuan Yew and Rajaratnam would have interpreted it. You know, the split of Singapore and Malaysia into two separate countries is accomplished with a minimum of violence relative to, let's say, the partition of India. So I think there's a confidence in a techno-futurism. I think it's not accidental that Singapore happens upon technology as the savior for small nations without major resources. And as we know, Singapore actually built itself, you know, Singapore built itself a gateway, and one of the gateways was, of course, technology transfer.
Yes.
Right? So I think this unwieldy gathering of the non-aligned movement reveals to him which global coalitions won't work for Singapore. And therefore, they deprioritize you know, trying to be part of this. They're still in it membership-wise, but it's no longer a priority of the 73. And they prioritize smaller blocks, which they can manage and which can focus on trade. And I think ASEAN is also built on the idea of similarity of objectives and not very much about population differences. It's not that kind of alignment. I think, you know, of the various alignments that come about, there's non-aligned movement, of course. There's Organization of Islamic Cooperation that I mentioned, which really comes into its own next year, which is the meeting that Bangladesh goes to, 74 in Pakistan. And in the film, I talk about this as a pivot because non-alignment and Islamic cooperation is not the same thing, right? Non-alignment is a broad tent where a lot of people can be there, maybe too many people, but still there's no membership constraint other than not being American aligned. Although, of course, as you mentioned, Singapore is in there. But Islamic cooperation requires a majority Islamic country. And then even that definition is fraught because India is not allowed to be a member of the Islamic Cooperation Organization, even though today India has 200 million Muslims, which is second or third largest population. Indonesia's first. India's either second or third, right? But India's not allowed because Pakistan blocks India's access over Kashmir, right? So OIC is not an open space that everyone can enter. And the definition of being in OIC is to be Islamic, whatever that might mean. And for Bangladesh, it's a major about face because certainly whatever basis on which the 1971 war was fought, after the breaking of Pakistan, there was certainly a liberal consensus that was emerging that religion isn't going to be a defining factor of our nation. And in the constitution, initially, you know, secularism is enshrined, whichever Westminster or whichever definition of secularism. I presume that because the two lawyers who drafted Kamal Hussein and Amirul Islam are both British trained.
Yes.
So secularism, socialism are two of the platforms of the constitution. And then by 74, not only does Bangladesh go to the OIC meeting, but the OIC meeting is held in Pakistan. And it's the first time that the Bangladesh head of state goes to Pakistan.
Yes.
So that's also seen as it's a surprise. You could see it as a political victory for Bangladesh, but you could also see it as a political victory for Pakistan because the meeting is being held on there. So there's that whole thing, who presents what. So there's that pivot into this thing. And then we also have to understand that Organization of Islamic Cooperation is an attempt to have an umbrella different from OPEC, because OPEC is oil power, capital. OIC is everybody. That means everybody who doesn't have oil also, which means by definition, these countries with a majority Islamic Muslim population, which are now inside an alignment that also includes the oil power bloc. But the oil power bloc and, you know, the power of a country with oil, especially in 73, at the height of the beginning of the oil crisis and price club cartels and all of that, is very different from, let's say, a country like Bangladesh. So you're not on an equal platform at all, right? And that, I think that generates a whole sort of, like, you maybe wouldn't call it colonization, but a sort of soft oil power nation colonization of places like Bangladesh, at least in terms of other forms of domination, you know, not legislative control, but other forms.
So this rich and very complex period that you bring to life in Two Meetings and a Funeral is also a time that is re-invoked later on.
And so it would be useful to examine how people relate to this period in the 1970s right now. And in the context of Bangladesh, this goes back to the genocide of 1971 and the tribunals that have been held in recent times to allocate responsibility for that violence.
Yeah, I mean, the tribunals related to the 1971 genocide is a very complex terrain, and I won't get to address all of it, but maybe I'll address one part of it that I feel I witnessed firsthand. The thing about the war crimes tribunals, there's a few spokes. The first thing to talk about is the fact that the 1971 war that liberates Bangladesh is accompanied by a genocide that's recorded in the media. Now, presumably, or actually, the Pakistan Army is the primary agent of the genocide.
Yeah.
But most of the discussion around war crimes after 1971 have not been about the Pakistan Army. In fact, they have been surprisingly not about the Pakistan Army, all things considered. The Pakistanis who became prisoners of war, soldiers and officers after the war, first of all, were not even in Bangladesh. They were in Indian captivity, and they were handed over in, I think, 72, 73. So they're all in Pakistan now. They never faced any trials. India didn't try to have war crimes trials either. It wasn't India's interest either, right? So the primary actors are nowhere in this conversation. That's the first thing to know about. None of these tribunals are about bringing a Pakistani army officer to Bangladesh to face trial. The tribunals focus on the second layer, which I think is really important to understand from nation's sense of itself. It focuses on the betrayers within, right? So it focuses on Bengalis, using a broad definition of Bengali, but let's presume Bengali speakers or people of former East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, and before that is Bengal, those who aligned with the Pakistan Army. And the easiest way to define them is either through membership of the Islamist party that was a tiny force in 71, but then was a major force about, let's say, 10 years ago, or other forms of alignment, let's say at the rural level, that caused them to be the enforcers, right? Yeah. Because the Pakistan Army is not going village by village to control the village. Neither they had the resources, nor they had the interest. They were perfectly comfortable with local enforcers for each of the villages. And, you know, these kinds of local enforcement mechanisms during a war in a village, at the village level, doesn't even need a command structure. You know, you don't need to get a memo from the Pakistan Army in West Pakistan saying you are hereby authorized. You just do it because you're the local mastan of that village, right? After the war ends, you are denounced as the person who is allied with the Pakistan Army. All this is clear. These people become the focus of war crimes trial. Among the many challenges of the tribunal is the fact that it was held more than 40 years after the war. And that 40-year period was not marked by a focus on keeping documents, right? There was not a process of, I mean, there was some process of oral history, but not enough if you think that these oral histories will later be used for court cases. They were not the sort of documents gathered that are the sort of documents you gather if you think these have to come to court. They were more along the lines of oral history, oral narratives, sufficient to establish a what in my actually PhD dissertation I call Jana Kotha, which translates to known truth. They're sufficient to establish that, oh, that family or that person, we know what they did during the war, but they're not sufficient as evidence in the courts. So then when you have a trial process 40 years later, you have this challenge of trying to try people and not having the sort of evidence you might want. So in any case, the trials happen and some guilty verdicts are found. And then one person who was somewhat notorious and therefore within the frame of what people would say, jana kotha, known fact, was not given the death penalty. And it was a figure that was polarizing enough that it instantly generated these street protests, which is a Shahbag movement, which then exploded and grew larger and larger until it became almost a national movement. Now, what I talked about at Goldsmiths is that Shahbag also erupts in 2013 on the heels of Occupy Wall Street, Arab Spring, and yes, the Age of Uprisings. So I think specifically people are both used to and expecting to see these kinds of uprisings in a global context. And I remember actually in the first week of that uprising, which was definitely social media accelerated, it was at a time when everyone could have an opinion about it. You don't need to wait for the television camera. The first few days, it was actually called Shahbag Square, which is a nod to Tahrir Square. And then it went back to not being that because that's not the original title. And this movement grows, it's written about, etc. And I think for liberal progressive consensus in my generation, it's a profoundly confusing and confounding moment, because you have a movement that is youth generated, is social media accelerated, have many women in very visible positions, runs all night, therefore even this question of everyone is safe there, has some of the same ideas that we believe in, secularism, etc., etc., Bengali culture, and yet at its core is a demand for an execution, right? And so that becomes a very complicated thing, that you want this energy, but some of us were uncomfortable with the demand for death penalty. And so I think what it actually did in the end is a fractured liberal opinion. You know, this liberal consensus that existed, that for 40 years was focused on the idea of justice for war crimes, but hadn't actually had to face the reality of what that would look like, suddenly faced a street uprising that, you know, if a street uprising has the ability to overturn a verdict, that is all right as long as you are facing an unjust verdict. But once that genie is let out of the bottle, it can be leveraged again. And in the future, not every such case might be the same. And just to give an adjacent example, in Pakistan, there were major street uprisings about the acquittal of, I'm forgetting what her name is exactly, it might be Asia Bibi, but I might be wrong about that, who was acquitted on blasphemy charges, right, which happened right after Imran Khan's election. So some people felt this was Imran Khan's new liberal consensus, although he might not actually have had anything to do with it. And there the street uprisings were for, no, she's blasphemous, you have to overturn this verdict. Yeah. And I remember one of my friends saying, oh, Pakistan, you know, what a hellish situation, as, you know, somebody might be inclined to do from the Bangladesh side of the border with the ghosts of 71. And I said, but you know, we had a similar uprising, except that was a objective that everyone thought was a good objective. So you see the challenge of sudden rule. I would say that I tried to write about it, but I found it quite difficult to write about it because the environment was so overheated. I tried to write about it with op-ed where I tried to talk about an earlier case where people were executed very quickly, and I tried to make an argument that, oh, you know, people should be, you know, there should be a process where actually stories are recorded, which is an idea of truth and reconciliation, which is the idea of the accused eventually admitting in public what they did. And that's, you know, there's an argument that the accused admitting what they did in public and apologizing to the victims is a more reparative process. But we are not necessarily in a political situation right now in the world where people have patience with reparative processes, right? Yes. There's also the fear that, oh, you'll initiate a reparative process now, and in the future, you know, if there's a different political dispensation, that thing will be overturned.
Yes.
So death penalties are also seen as final.
Yes.
You can't overturn them.
Yes.
I haven't even scratch the surface of that moment, but I think a profoundly complicated moment for liberal progressive coalitions, intellectuals and cultural workers who were formerly quite united in what they wanted,
yeah,
and then face the situation where it was extremely difficult to get to any consensus on what would be a good outcome.
Yes. I mean, I think what you highlight here is pertinent to many contexts. The ambiguities that you've talked about in the context of the war crimes tribunal, and in fact the histories that we're trying to access, whether that's the non-aligned movement or that of socialist and left horizons of the 1960s and 70s, that we are all ambiguous subjects who've been made right. by these histories, and we're trying to recover moments of it primarily because they're also so relevant to the challenges that we're facing today.
We're living in the immediate aftermath of, I mean, everything that's happened post-2001, pre-2001, 89, 2001, all of these ruptures are in the aftermath of the 70s utopian project failing.
Yes.
So we're dealing with a long aftermath. We're shaped by that, actually. Yeah.
Great. That's fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stuart. That's great.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.